This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 5 days a week. I'm Roz Taylor. Most of us, and I'm guessing most of the listeners to this podcast, regard people who fall for conspiracy theories with a mixture of amusement and contempt. There have been remarkably few attempts to find out who these people are, why they start believing in these theories, and how social media has encouraged them. But one woman who has been doing that is Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent. She spent the past 4 years digging deep into the worlds of trolls, grifters, malevolent influencers, and the people who follow them. And she joins me in the studio today. Welcome to The Bunker, Mariana.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was really striking to me how much you've travelled for your job. You can track down disinformation from your desk at the BBC, but you've chosen to go out there and find the people spreading it. That must take quite a lot of courage.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm a big believer in coming face to face with people is one of the most effective ways, I think, of really understanding and revealing why they're behaving in the way they are on social media. And I think there can be, I don't know, people often think that my job probably involves just sitting with lots of phones and lots of computers, which it does quite a lot of the time, investigating this stuff. But actually, I think the same good old-fashioned investigative journalism that we've done for the past few decades can be applied to this world. And so it's really valuable to go out there and to meet the people who really believe this stuff, the devoted followers, as well as the people who are perhaps benefiting in some way from spreading conspiracy theories, whether that's financially or through growing a following. And then also there's holding the social media companies to account, although that doesn't involve going out and about. That tends to involve sending lots of emails and getting very generic replies.
You've even tried to engage the people who threaten to kill you because of the job you do, haven't you?
Yeah, and I was chatting actually to Justin Webb, who's at the BBC. I do Americast with him, a different podcast. And we were chatting about this the other day because we were sitting in the same kind of office space and he went, why do you message them? Because I was like, I'm just messaging some of my trolls. And he was like, why are you messaging them? And I was like, oh, well, I want to understand. I want to be able to ask them some questions. I do find that when you do message people, I mean, either they will just block you and don't want to speak to you. But if you go in with that kind of investigative mindset of, I genuinely want to understand why you're sending me this and what's going on here, you do often get answers and people do reflect on why they've behaved in that way. It's somewhat easier investigating other people's trolls, which I spend a lot of time doing, because when you come face to face with them, they're perhaps less of a worry for you and much more a worry for the person who's being targeted. But they often are cut from the same cloth. You find the same kinds of things motivating people. They're very angry. They're very frustrated. They almost don't see what they're doing on social media as real. And actually on the blurb of my book, I say some of my trolls say they want to kill me, because I think that say does quite a lot of heavy lifting. I think quite a lot of them say they want to kill me, but I don't, touch wood, whether they would actually do it is kind of another question.
And you have actually met a couple of them, haven't you? How did they react?
I found when I speak to the people that send me abuse specifically, it's almost like you become a real person sort of in front of their eyes, kind of like magic. And they're kind of like, oh, hold on a second. You're not a kind of character or a, no, it's almost like you're kind of a figment of their imagination. You're not real. And when you do talk to them and confront them and ask them questions, they are able to then reflect on that and say, oh, hang on a second. There was one particularly memorable conversation with a man called Steve who had sent me various messages that were abusive, not the most extreme abuse I've received, but certainly some pretty nasty stuff. And he basically turned around and said to me, well, you know, well, I get trolled. I get trolled for saying 9/11 wasn't real and 7/7 wasn't real. I was like, well, I don't think that's quite the same, Steve. Thank you so much, though. But it was interesting. And in the end, he, you know, he's never sent me an abusive message again. And the problem is I can't talk to all of my trolls. Yeah, and I can't talk to everybody's trolls. And so that alone, just having these kinds of conversations, perhaps is not the entire solution.
Some people say, and it's undoubtedly true, that some of these online threats are just performative. The people making them would never follow through. And that is undoubtedly true for many. But do you think it's always going to be true?
I think that the majority of the time, these messages are empty and that people won't do anything. But I do think there is, as I've spent what feels like a lifetime now reporting on, a real connection between what happens online and what happens offline. And I think particularly the, you know, continued and sustained hateful and violent rhetoric online and threats directed at individuals, which, you know, is by no means just me. There are loads of journalists, doctors, politicians, teachers who experience this kind of hate. And also I'm fortunate to not receive racist abuse or homophobic abuse or other kinds of hate. But I do think that that sustained hate can spill offline because it normalizes that kind of aggression and abuse. I've had a couple of experiences myself that have involved people turning up outside the BBC or being kind of based outside the BBC who have been particularly abusive to me. And to me, that kind of, it didn't really surprise me because I see so much hate online all the time. I think, well, of course, this makes sense. But I think for a lot of people, that is quite shocking. And I think one thing I say quite a lot is that these conspiracy theory movements are often really passionate about freedom of expression. And they target me because they believe in some way I'm curbing freedom of expression, which is not the case. And if you believe in freedom of expression to, you know, abuse a young investigative journalist as she goes into her place of work in a democracy, doesn't seem very freedom of speech oriented.
Do you think you get a harder time because you're a woman?
The abuse I get is very misogynistic a lot of the time. It focuses on me as a woman, and I'm either a kind of silly puppet woman who obviously could never be clever enough to report on this kind of thing, or I am a evil satanic whore who's going to sort of eat everyone. I'm none of those things. So yeah, I think a lot of it does focus on me being a woman, and I think a lot of what makes people, I hope, like the journalism I do is that I try to really humanize it and bring it to life, and I like to take the audience with me. But I think that has very much made me a lightning rod for the trolls and all sorts, because people kind of see me as someone they can also take aim at, an individual. It's not as perhaps satisfying as a troll just to have a go at the BBC or a generic programme when you can have a go at a person. And they also happen to be a young woman.
You've done a lot of digging, and this is something that other people I don't think have done really, on how some areas of Britain have become super vulnerable to conspiracy thinking. Tell us about that and where they are.
Yeah, so there are a few places I've visited where there have been particularly active, I'd say, conspiracy theory movements or underbellies almost. And they're not always places you'd anticipate. One is Totnes, which is in the southwest of the UK, which has a reputation for being very embracing, welcoming towards kind of alternative ideas and cultures. But there's a small group within that town who have become very much a part of the conspiracy theory movement. And when I talk about that, you know, there are people with legitimate concerns and questions. There are real examples of politicians who do bad things all the time. But when I talk about the conspiracy theory movement, I'm generally talking about people who subscribe to much more extreme worldviews. This idea that COVID-19 was a hoax, wars are staged, terror attacks have been staged, you know, everything bad that happens is basically somehow never really happened. And I think in Totnes in particular, it's quite a lot of people who I think probably would traditionally situate themselves on the left, who have found themselves drawn into these ideologies and perhaps to rhetoric that is more often associated with far right groups and movements. And I tend to find that on the whole, that people who perhaps sit on political extremes or even regard themselves as almost outside of the traditional political system, who've lost faith in it, are more vulnerable to this. Yeah, in the book, I talk quite a lot about kind of the different people I meet in Totnes. And there's a very active anti-conspiracy theory movement there too. You know, local councillors, people who are very, very passionate about protecting the identity of their town, which they see as a beacon of freedom of expression and somewhere where people shouldn't be exposed to hate or intimidated. But they worry that that has become the case and that there are various examples they described to me where they were really concerned about, you know, protests getting nasty or individuals being targeted. The other place that I've spent, well, there are quite a lot of places I've spent a lot of time looking at conspiracy theories, but another place I spent quite a lot of time was in Shrewsbury, which is obviously, you know, this very pretty market town, perhaps not the kind of place you'd anticipate conspiracy theories thriving. But again, during the pandemic in particular, there was a very active conspiracy theory movement there. And, you know, there was a really sad and shocking story about one man called Gary, who was 44 years old and thought COVID wasn't real and subsequently lost his life because of COVID. And he was sort of an active member of the conspiracy theory movement there. So I tend to find that, you know, these, I wouldn't say there are conspiracy towns, but there are kind of conspiracy sections of towns, and they're often very loud and they'll be protesting. I mean, people listening might have seen, I don't know if you've ever been driving around a roundabout and seen people holding up those big yellow signs, which will say things like, insert here is a hoax, or, you know, and that's actually still happening now. I think a lot of people thought after the pandemic, some of these movements and groups would subside. But I think a lot of people have found purpose and community and meaning in being a part of this stuff. And so it very much hasn't gone anywhere. In fact, I'm busier than probably I've ever been.
What kinds of people are especially likely to fall down the conspiracy rabbit hole? Because you mentioned they were often angry, but are they angry because they feel that they're not being listened to and their beliefs are not being listened to? Or were they angry anyway? And what other characteristics do they have, would you say?
Yeah, I think the anger is often an anger born from frustration. They feel like no one's listening to them or hearing them, or that they don't have any agency or power. I find that to be quite a common attribute of people who really believe this stuff. And I guess this is talking about the true believers, as I'd sort of term them, the people who are genuinely devoted followers and think what they're subscribing to is real. Other things that they tend to have in common: hyper-curious, very engaged, often very, very overactive users of social media. They're often people who are seeking out community, not necessarily because they don't have friends and family, often they do, but they're seeking out a kind of a group, a purpose. And I often think, you know, I guess several decades ago, you would have gone and hung out on a real town square where you talked to all kinds of different people. Now that town square is virtual and it's full of disinformation and hate and other nasty stuff. And you find a lot of people who totally agree, perhaps with your more extreme ideas. And that's what some of these people do. There's lots of misconceptions, I think. This idea that people are very gullible, I tend to find is not the case. It's much more so that they're very cynical. They've often had a bad experience that has left them vulnerable to being exploited by conspiracy theory movements. And I think it's helpful to kind of try and dispel to some extent the misconceptions and the kind of caricatures we have about people who believe conspiracy theories, because I think it sort of stops us being able to really try and connect and understand, even when it's easy to kind of want to dismiss this stuff because it's actually really frustrating. And I think particularly I get lots of people who've got, you know, a friend or a family member who's really into this stuff, and it's really hard to have a conversation because they'll just double down.
So they're the kinds of people who might have got heavily into religion in the past, and that's not to criticise people who might be religious, but it fulfills the same need for to be part of a community and to believe.
Yeah, I think that, and like you say, you know, it's important to underline that, you know, this is very different to a religion. But I think that with an absence of religion and to some extent local community in a lot of communities, people turn to other places for that outlet and for that sense of community and meaning and purpose. And I find that a lot too, that people are kind of seeking fulfillment. They really feel let down. They don't feel as though they've had the opportunities they'd like. And this gives them a real purpose and meaning. And they become, I don't know, I think a lot of the people I've met feel much more appreciated by the conspiracy theory movements, perhaps, than they do in their day-to-day life. You know, in their day-to-day life, they might just be your average Joe going about their life. Whereas in this movement, they're like a freedom warrior and they're fighting for justice and they're fighting against bad. And that's actually something I find a lot. One of the really common attributes I've found are people who really care about humanity. They kind of are really worried. And Gary, who died in Shrewsbury, all of his friends and family, relatives who I spoke to, they said, you know, he cared so much about people. He was very worried about war and very anti-war. And that was kind of what led him down the rabbit hole initially to disinformation around the war that was unfolding in Syria at the time. Or in Totnes at one of the protests, there was this woman called Natalie. And the moment really stays with me, actually, because I think it tells you how far some people have fallen down the rabbit hole. She was at this protest and we started talking, and she thought climate change was a hoax and, you know, ways of dealing with pollution, limitations that were being introduced to deal with pollution and everything else were part of this attempt to thwart us and harm us and kill us even, control our lives. And then out of nowhere, she just burst into tears. I was really quite taken aback, actually. It was very sort of raw emotion. She was really upset. But you would be, right, if you believed that everyone you love was going to be killed by some conspiracy overlord. And I just found it so sad because she kind of says, you know, basically I've lost all my friends and family trying to fight for this cause. And now all she has left is this group of people who are around her. And then sort of off she went with her big megaphone telling us that we were all going to succumb to the overlords. It was just really sad.
Quite tragic in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've tried to pull people out of it. Sometimes you compare yourself at one point in the book to an agony aunt. What works when you're trying to convince someone? Because I've tried this occasionally with the odd relative and totally failed.
Yeah, I think it's the sort of million-dollar question, really. It's the question I get asked all the time. And there are some people who I've, you know, whose stories I've investigated who genuinely have managed to get out of the rabbit hole. And so they've offered some really valuable insights into how they did that. For a lot of people, it happens over a very long period of time. And I think that can be particularly frustrating for friends and family because you want them to just snap out of it and say, oh, sorry about that. I had a bit of a funny half hour, but I'm all right now. But that does not tend to happen. So often it's having lots of conversations, and it can feel, I think, quite difficult to not have an argument, because if you fundamentally disagree with what someone's saying, it can be difficult to sort of listen to it and not say, oh, hang on a second. But actually, I think that that is crucial to be able to not get too bogged down in the what they believe, but to ask why and to keep trying to figure out, what are you worried about? What has led you to this point? Separate the legitimate concerns from the more extreme conspiratorial thinking. I think question people's sources. Say, well, hang on, who's this person? What do they, you know, tell me about them. Why are you watching their videos? Or why did you come across their content? Because I think by being able to demonstrate that, hang on, this person has a track record of misleading people or making money out of it, they might realise that they too are kind of falling victim to that person. And I think the other thing is to really sort of encourage them to think about the way that they're using social media and the way their feed works and what it looks like. Because a lot of conspiracy theorists say to me, I do my own research, and, you know, do you? You mustn't. But actually, I would love them to do their own research. It'd be great to kind of step back and say, hang on a second, what's true here? What's not true? What can I trust? What can't I trust?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Let's talk about teenagers, because I hear more and more voices saying that they shouldn't be allowed to use social media until they're 16. You investigated the murder of Ollie, a teenager in Reading, and social media played a big part in that. What happened?
So Ollie was leaving his house. It was just after New Year, and he was attacked in a field just near from where he lived, and was killed. And there were two teenage boys and a teenage girl who were later convicted of involvement in what happened to him. And after he was killed, it was only then that his mum and dad began to realise the role that social media had played in what happened, particularly a world of bullying and violence and hate that existed on Ollie's phone, but very privately separate to them. And that's something I hear a lot from parents, that they don't see what their kids are being recommended and targeted with, and so, or just, you know, being exposed to. And so they have no idea until sometimes it's too late. And Ollie's dad sent me an Instagram message. It was about a year after Ollie'd been killed, saying, Mariner, we'd seen a BBC panorama you'd done, and would you investigate? And so I set out to really understand what had happened. And, you know, they managed to prosecute the entire case on social media evidence, because there was so much. They didn't have to call any of these teenagers as witnesses, because there were loads of voice notes and messages. And one of the most revealing bits of looking into what happened to Ollie and you know, the role that bullying and hate and other things had played, one of the most revealing moments was actually getting together a group of his friends. I set up a sort of undercover dummy account to test what teenagers are being recommended and exposed to, including, you know, being recommended knives for sale and some really quite shocking violent content. And all of his friends just said, well, yeah, we see this stuff all the time. We see it all the time. You know, you constantly are worried. So you've got, there's the violence. Then there's also the bullying and the hate. You constantly feel like someone's going to film you and they might post it. And then what happens? And it was really revealing. And I'm someone who grew up with social media sort of at the bit where I was about 14 when I got Instagram. But these are kids whose whole lives are online. And, you know, Ollie's mum and dad, I think another moment that really stays with me, kind of said to me, you know, when Ollie died in the field by our house, the bosses from Silicon Valley, the social media companies, they weren't there. They've never had anything to do with us. And, you know, it's the greatest privilege of doing this job is being able to investigate stories like theirs and to, you know, put those questions to the social media companies. Getting answers is another question. But because this is a recurring theme, and like you say, you know, there have been countless stories Breonna Gay's murder, but also Molly Russell, who took her own life. There are so many examples of teenagers and young people being harmed. And I think that, you know, I always say I'm an investigative reporter, not a campaigner, but all credit to the parents and families of those children who've worked tirelessly to make people realise. And I find their lack of answers, the lack of answers they get, really, as a journalist, just really shocking to think that bad stuff can happen and no one actually holds up their hands and says, sorry, we got something wrong there.
Well, there is, of course, the online safety bill, which is coming up, and there's a lot riding on it, a lot of hopes. Do you think it will make things better?
I think on the one hand, it shows a willingness from policymakers and various important people to do something about social media harm and to kind of tackle it. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about regulation of the social media companies, and in some ways it's pretty, you know, it's pretty ahead of lots of other places. Lots of the parents who've been affected by social media harm and their children have are really happy to see this pass. They again see it as a kind of signal that we care about this, we're going to do something about it. And a lot of it does focus on children and harm to young people and illegal content as well. On the flip side, there are quite a lot of people I've spoken to who are really concerned that it's quite hard to enforce. Ofcom, the regulator, will be effectively in charge of asking the social media companies to make commitments to what they're going to do to protect their users, and then to show at the end of that that they've honoured those commitments or they face fines or other kinds of repercussions. I think to some degree that's good, but again, the social media companies are not known for being transparent, and I wonder about the level of transparency that there will be. And I just wonder how all of this will work in practice. I mean, one of the most difficult things when we talk about children and social media is two-tiered social media doesn't exist. You know, kids use the same social media sites and platforms that adults do, and there is not a way right now of separating the kinds of content they're seeing from what adults are seeing. So, I think it will. I think for a lot of people who've been harmed, it marks a commitment. But there are other people who fear the harms that have affected them are not even really within the scope of the bill.
And we sometimes assume that teens are just scrolling TikTok and Snapchat and whatever in quite a passive way. But last year, it was the trigger for widespread protests, wasn't it? Which were quite shocking.
Yeah, so I have spent quite a lot of time investigating frenzies unfolding on TikTok in particular, which is obviously an increasingly popular app, especially with younger people. Yeah, there were various examples of disorder and harm erupting offline. I mean, people might remember there were some school protests that started happening at school in Liverpool, but they very quickly spread like wildfire on TikTok with teenagers posting protest videos, which in and of itself is, you know, a good thing. Kids want to protest, stick up for what they believe in. That's great. The problem was is that this was descending into violence. You know, there were police had to be called, riot police had to be called. There was vandalism. There was all kinds of sort of hate violence directed at teachers as well. And it got really out of control. And I received so many messages from people saying, there's something going on here. And I started to notice this pattern because this had all happened in schools. Around the same time, people might remember a woman called Nicola Bully went missing in St Michael's on Wire in Lancashire. And again, this frenzy unfolded on TikTok where people were directing the most awful false claims, hate at her family, her friends who were trying to deal with her disappearance at the time. She was later, you know, ruled to have died by drowning in the river close to where she'd last been seen. And people were turning up at the scene. They were trespassing on nearby property. They were harassing people, targeting people who were in any way connected to this. And, you know, for me, this is all about the algorithm, the way that the algorithm works, because, you know, on TikTok especially, it's kind of known for its infamous and quite powerful algorithm. You go on it once, you watch one thing and you get loads more of the same thing. And this was all about the speed and the scale that that kind of content can be recommended to people and the way I think it can distort social norms, what we perceive to be acceptable. I think particularly for kids, because how do we decide what's socially acceptable? Well, we take our cues from people who are around us and the way that they behave. If we're getting those cues from social media and millions of people are watching these videos, then that's where we're kind of getting our sense of what's okay and not okay. And I put all of this to TikTok at the time, who told me that they do work to protect users and to mitigate against people being recommended too much of the same content, that they don't prioritize profit over safety. Lots of the insiders I spoke to pointed out that a lot of this is just down to the way the platforms work, which they believe the social media companies don't have any interest in changing.
This is the thing, isn't it? Because the teens involved probably saw it as empowering, as you say, and they were getting together to right an injustice, you know, whether it was girls' skirt lengths or toilets out of bounds during lessons or stuff like that. Is that important in understanding how social media makes people feel and why they can behave in horrible ways on it?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think as well that what's so difficult about all of this is it often really does start with something that's valid and legitimate. So in the case of these protests, you've got kids who are genuinely feel as though it's unfair. Uniform rules targeting girls, they're not happy with them, they don't like them. And it's good in many ways that kids are able to connect with each other and, you know, organise these pretty sort of effective protest movements, I guess. That's a good thing. The problem is the way that it gets out of control and out of hand, and the extent to which it's almost this. Quite a few sort of insiders from the social media companies have described this to me, but this sort of competition, this gamification of social media where you're constantly trying to one-up the other user or copy what they're doing and do even worse. And that's certainly what was happening here. We saw a similar thing unfolding when there were riots in France, again involving teenagers, triggered by the murder of a young man by police. But it very quickly descended into, again, places where this had never happened before, like quite small towns where people were, you know, attacking cars and buses and setting things on fire in a way that just was totally alien to them. And I think that tells you about the reach social media can have and that behavioural impact, which is that you copy people, you one-up them, and also you want views and likes, and there's that incentive as well. You know that if you do something even more extreme, you'll get more views. And that's a difficult thing, I think, for people to not be kind of attracted to, even when it causes harm.
Thanks so much, Mariana.
Thanks for having me.
You can support The Bunker in a small way, it's as little as £3 a month, by searching for Patreon Bunker Podcast. That's what keeps us going, so we're really grateful for your support. I'm Ros Taylor, thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Liam Tate, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.